The English Collective of Prostitutes is against the new laws, expected to affect 90% of Britain's sex workers. It says every prostitute will be punished. It accuses the government of inflating the number of those forced to work against their will. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Election workers in Minnesota are starting a long recount of the state's Senate race. Nearly 3 million ballots were cast, and incumbent Republican Norm Coleman is winning the race by a little more than 200 votes. The recount was called for by state law. It's supposed to be completed by December 5th. There is still a dispute to be settled over some absentee ballots that have been rejected for technical reasons. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. When General David Petraeus became America's top commander in Iraq in January of 2007, he faced a massive challenge to find a new strategy that would change the course of the war. There are many people who believe that he has managed to do just that, although certainly the future of Iraq and U.S. involvement there is far from certain. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Linda Robinson. She is a journalist who has written extensively on national security issues. She has had an opportunity to spend some significant time in Iraq and has spent time talking with General Petraeus and with his officers and the people who serve under him. She's authored a book based on all of this experience. The title of her book is Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. The publisher on the book is Public Affairs and has been out for a while now. So if you'd like to look at the book, you can certainly head down to the bookstore or to the library and to look at it. Our guest, Linda Robinson, is author in residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She has covered Iraq, also Afghanistan and Latin America, as well as other national security issues. She was for a number of years a senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. She's the author of the book Masters of Chaos, The Secret History of the Special Forces. She's also contributed articles to Foreign Affairs, World Policy Journal, Survival, New Republic, Outside, and Condé Nast Traveler. She was a Nieman Fellow at the Harvard University and also senior editor of Foreign Affairs. She is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, certainly questions, comments from listeners are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are calling in is that they are brief so that we can keep our show moving along. But certainly anyone who is interested to join the conversation can do that. 333-9455, that's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So again, any point here, you have questions, comments, you can give us a call. Ms. Robinson, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
I appreciate it. The title of the book, this is a quote from General Petraeus. What were the circumstances? When was it that he said this?
He said this in April 2003, actually to another journalist who was traveling with him at the time in Iraq. General Petraeus was the commander of the 101st Airborne Division in that early, the major combat phase of the war. And he turned to this reporter and said, "You tell me how this ends." The implication is that Petraeus realized very early on this was not going to be a short war. And I would say also there were plenty of other generals and astute officers who realized that you can't just go into a place like Iraq and leave the next day.
So this clearly was an expression of his personal frustration, perhaps all personal and professional frustration, over just what a difficult situation this was, and over the fact that it was, as you say, it was not going to be easily or quickly resolved.
Yes, I think it was almost a philosophical observation, just that, when the U.S., any country goes to war, It's a major endeavor and a major undertaking. So I think that the inherent unpredictability of war was really what he was noting. And I think that as he moved on up to Mosul, he then quickly got a crash course in those complexities, because Iraq is really a mosaic of different populations, both ethnic groups and religious or sectarian groups. And it's that mosaic, really, that the U.S. has been trying to deal with ever since.
Well, it seems to me that thinking back, even before when we knew that we were going into Iraq, but before the troops actually went in, that there were a lot of people who said something like this. They said, well, there really can be no doubt that the U.S. military can defeat the military of Saddam Hussein. That's not something that's open to question. The big question that I think a lot of people were raising, and obviously enough thought hadn't been devoted to it, but the big question was, what happens then? What happens afterwards? And I wonder whether you indeed get the sense that there, within the military, there also were people, even going back before the United States actually went in, that would have said the same thing and would have asked the same questions.
I think there were a lot of people who realized that this was going to be a difficult endeavor, but I guess I'd like to stress two things. One is, of course, military officers are sworn to obey the orders and decisions of their superiors. Now, at the topmost level, of course, they have input into the decision-making process. But once the decisions are made by the civilians, then they have a choice to go ahead and carry them out, or resigning, of course, is always a course open to them. But most professional military officers look upon it as their job to try to carry out what the civilian leaders order them to do. But I think also we should, I don't want to misportray my book, which really does not revisit the decision to go to war, because what I really was focused on was, now we have it, right? Now we're there. What do we do? And I begin by recapping all of the errors and missteps that were made really in the 2003-2006 time frame, once we were already in Iraq. And that's the prelude to Petraeus coming in February 07, handed this sort of last-ditch assignment. How do we try at the very last moment to turn around what is clearly, by early 07, a failing, if not failed, war?
Well, as you said, and quite correctly, for the people who are in the military, once the leadership, once the civilian leadership says go, you go, and that is your choice. You can either say, all right, we're going to go, or you, at that point you could decide you're not going to be in the military anymore. So I'm just wondering if you had some sense from him, from General Petraeus, what he felt when he was now tapped for this very difficult assignment, and that was to be the top military commander in Iraq.
Well, he, and I do describe the long discussions that he had with his wife, Holly, because this certainly wasn't, as he put it, any assignment that one would seek. It was a very challenging assignment, and the heavy betting in all circles, really. I mean, I live here in Washington. Prognosis for Iraq was extremely pessimistic, and I was there during 2006 when the bloodletting was just phenomenal. The sectarian war, the civil war, had just really broken out in earnest. But he was asked to do it. He and Holly spent a lot of time discussing it, and he agreed to do it. And I think that there were a couple of key things that made him feel that he was the person who should step up to that. He had spent the last year plus overseeing the rewriting of the U.S. Army counterinsurgency manual, which had not been rewritten for 20 years since we were involved in the Central American insurgencies. So he had undertaken this exercise where he gathered a whole crew of academic, political, military, international even a bunch of journalists, I was part of it at one phase, and human rights experts, but he really got together kind of a graduate seminar of people who had been involved in insurgency, counterinsurgency studies, and put together a manual that really was designed to help figure out Iraq. So he was kind of was doing preparatory work for the job of commander in Iraq, which he assumed in February 07.
I don't want people to assume that necessarily I'm trying to be a booster for the general, or that you are either, but it seems pretty clear that your feeling is that when we, years hence, when we look back on Iraq and this phase of the U.S. involvement there, that among all of the military men who have served there and the people who have been in the top command positions, the guy who's going to stand out is this man, is David Petraeus.
I think that is a fair statement, and I record in the book. I mean, he has his rivals, he has his critics, and he certainly has his flaws. So there's no doubt this is a human being, you know, we're talking about. But I think that he did make an attempt to really understand the phase of the war. And what I think is above all critical is he was willing to wade into the politics of it. And this is really important, I think, certainly for this kind of war. Wars are inherently political issues. People are motivated to fight for political reasons. And if you're not ready to grapple with those and find ways of addressing those political motivations, your chances of bringing a war to a conclusion and altering its trajectory are very slim indeed. But I would also like to note the book has a lot of characters in it, and Petraeus, one of his hallmarks as a leader is he reaches out to smart people. His deputy commander was a British general named Graham Lamb, who's quite a colorful figure, but he was instrumental in arguing for the need to reach out to the Sunni insurgency and then subsequently to the Shia armed militias. And that was, in my view, really the pivotal part of the strategy, although there were many associated tactics. But there were also other smart generals and other smart officers at lower echelons. And Petraeus runs a very flat organization. I would see him time and again, you know, reach out to someone who was five or six rungs below him on the military ladder. He was also very good at reaching across to the embassy, both the ambassador, Ryan Crocker, but also people within the ambassador's team who came to sit in on the daily briefings. So he really had kind of an open-door policy, and he's quite a networker. He's up on email at all hours, and he really casts a big net. So I think it's important to share the credit for what was accomplished in 07 and 08 with the big cast of characters.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580, Linda Robinson. She is author in residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And was a writer for a number of years for U.S. News and World Report and covered the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq. She also reported from Latin America. She's written for a number of other publications. She's the author of a newly published book. The title of her book is Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. And the book is published by Public Affairs. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in and join the conversation, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or you might happen to be listening on the internet across the country, either way, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, so we'll get right to them. Someone calling from Thomasboro, and they're on line number one. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sitting here, and she's mentioned the counterinsurgency manual. As I read through this, and when we put this together, I think it's very interesting to think on what it's really about. The counterinsurgency manual was written with directives, and you look at it, it's a way to diffuse any objections or any retaliation or whatever you want to have by the occupants of the nations that we've invaded. So it's designed very specifically to quell any rebellion. I mean, just going back through history. The other thing, too, is trying to find a way out of Iraq. when we started writing the battle plans for the invasion of Iraq back in the middle 90s, and the actual D-Day was set for November 20th of 2000 before the Bush 2 original election, there was not really any plan to get out. And there's not been any plan to get out because the idea was to occupy Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan to do the oil. So given the reality of those plans, and then with the, just horrendous casualty numbers that we're seeing from our engagements in, Desert Storm up to Iraqi Freedom, I mean, we've got 350,000 casualties from Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom alone, and close to 300,000 from Desert Storm alone. Does she have any idea what Petraeus is going to do? Because he's sure, to this date, been denying, delaying prompt and effective medical care, refusing to clean up all the environmental contamination. And it just seems like we're following the counterinsurgency manual to stay there forever.
Well, Ms. Robinson, you can respond however you like.
Yes, well, I actually think the COIN manual, if you read it, and it has been published by the University of Chicago Press with a very interesting preface by a Harvard professor named Sarah Sewell, the main point of the COIN manual is that no counterinsurgency will succeed unless that government has legitimacy in the eyes of its population. And what that meant applied to Iraq was the Sunnis felt left out of the government that had come to power as a result of some, I think we can safely say in hindsight, flawed elections in 2005. And so their incentive to stop fighting was actually zero. They were increasingly concerned that the objective of the Iraqi government was to liquidate them or at least drive them from their homes and any positions of influence and deny them a role in the military. And so what began, I think, to change the dynamic was first in Anbar, some of those tribal sheikhs started coming over to the U.S. side, and then Petraeus came in and sort of made it the national policy to conduct outreach to those Sunnis who were willing to stop fighting and willing to stop supporting the insurgency, and that began changing the tide. There are a number of other things that still have to happen, incorporating them into the political, economic, and security system of the country, which has begun to different degrees, and we could talk about that. But anyway, that's really how I see the manual relating to what happened in Iraq. Now, in terms of the plan to get out, this, of course, is a very hot-button subject, and right now there's been an accord reached that still has to be ratified by the Iraqi parliament. The timeline envisioned there is 3 years to the removal of U.S. forces. And I just actually had an email exchange with the Iraqi National Security Advisor trying to clarify whether or not they envision having some residual presence for U.S. training and advisory forces, and they said, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. I think there is, and certainly on the part of the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Defense, they still see a need for some support roles down the road. But 3 years is a long time, and the first priority is to make sure this fragile peace, the ceasefire, which is really what I call it, because you still have to deal with some of the political issues at the heart of the conflict, you have to first make sure this ceasefire does not unravel. And I think the oil issue is, of course, something that people have great suspicions about. Is the U.S. there essentially just to claim the oil? The oil production has gone up dramatically. The infrastructure's been repaired. The Iraqi government now has quite substantial resources, $70, $80 billion in the bank from oil revenues that they are beginning to use to fund the reconstruction. And what is yet to be determined, though, through a national Iraqi national law, the hydrocarbons law, is just how they want to run their oil industry. I'm sure, though, there is going to be multinational oil companies involved. Iraq has a history of being a state-run economy, but I would be willing to put money on the continued involvement of U.S. and other, China, other countries' oil companies can be involved in the development of Iraqi oil. So I think that there are going to be a lot of players. It's a huge oil reserve country. So I would just say stay tuned on the oil front.
I want to thank the caller. I have somebody else I want to get to. Let's just take a step back, though, to the point right after the United States got involved and toppled Saddam Hussein. I think that there are some people who now would say that the insurgency was not a given. It was not inevitable, and that things that the United States did or didn't do really lay the groundwork for the insurgency. And somehow, if even going back to that time, if we had done some things differently, perhaps now we would, you know, we wouldn't be at the point we are now. I mean, what and maybe for some people this is ground that's been gone over a lot and it's pretty clear. But what would you say it was that the United States did wrong there initially that then it made it possible for the insurgency to get going?
Yes, thank you so much for stepping back to that point, because it is critical, and that is actually what my Chapter 1 deals with. There were critical decisions made, and many people do know this, but for the benefit of those who don't, the very first decrees that the Coalition Provisional Authority, the Occupation Authority led by Jerry Bremer, put out were really disastrous. Decree 1 and Decree 2 disbanded the Ba'athist Party, which had run Iraq for 30-some years, and then the decree that disbanded the security forces, the Iraqi army, the intelligence services, the police. So overnight, you threw out of work hundreds of thousands of people, and they were, in essence, given the message, you are now the enemy. And we then compounded that by holding elections in 2005 that the Sunnis boycotted. We went ahead and held those elections, and that, I think, was also, in hindsight, not the right decision, because then those people were not part of the local governments, and then they also were marginalized in the process of writing the 2005 Constitution, which is one of the big things that still needs to be re-looked, because there are many Iraqis who favor a more centralized form of government than the highly federal one that is now in the Constitution. And there are a lot of other issues. I won't go into too much detail, but the fundamental decisions made in 2003 to 2005 really set this thing on a course toward insurgency. But I would like to say, we can't be certain that it wouldn't have broken out anyway. I mean, this is, you know, it's counterfactual. You just don't know. But I think what happened was certain decisions were made that guaranteed that there would be an ongoing insurgency. And then in 2006, once you got the government of Nouri al-Maliki, that government then began behaving in certain ways and allowing and abetting the militias, Shiite militias that were beginning just really a systematic campaign of pushing people out of Sunni neighborhoods. And you now have, of course, a huge displaced population in and outside Iraq of over 4 million.
So without it sounds as if you're saying perhaps without intending to, the United States, in effect, allied itself with the Shia. And that the Sunnis then saw the United States as being a party to this effort to, in a sense, exterminate them or at the very least exclude them from the government.
Yes. I mean, in broad brushes, I think this is right. The Sunnis were treated as the enemy, and then the Sunnis began seeing us as abetting a not just a Shia domination of Iraq, but a Shia Islamist domination, because those were the parties that came to the fore as a result of they had organization and, you know, a variety of decisions were made that I think, again, in retrospect, were the wrong decisions. They empowered people in ways that they shouldn't have been. I have really come to believe from my many trips to Iraq that it is the bulk of the population is opposed to any kind of Islamist government. It's really a fairly cosmopolitan, secular country. There are Islamist parties, and they do have a real constituency, but I'm not sure that they have the majority. Even the parliament that was elected in the 2005 elections, those Islamist parties were only a plurality. They did not have a majority there. So I think we just need to have a little more fine-grained sense of what Iraq is and not paint it with some of the broad brushes that we have, which is to say it all wants to go in a certain direction because it doesn't.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. Next caller is in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Good morning. Once again, a very good topic. I guess my comment about Petraeus is that at least he doesn't seem to be too ideologued, and he is open to talking to the people in the region. And as much as I have distrust for the Iranians, he's even open to that. But, you know, you're dealing from strength, and you have to exhibit that. But I just can't see us just cutting off all communications. And from that standpoint, I think he has been, even though I kind of agree with the Thomasboro caller, I think he's been positive being in command over there.
Okay. Well, again, Ms. Robinson, you want to comment on that?
I would like to comment. I think that the comment is absolutely right that General Petraeus is not an ideologue. He's, I would say, quite pragmatic in his orientation, analyze the problem and figure out what it's going to take to address it. And many people may not be aware that we actually held several rounds of talks, the U.S. ambassador there, Ryan Crocker, did with Iran over the course of the last couple of years. And these were our first talks in 25 years with Iran. And even though the Iraqi government was the nominal host, these were really, you know, face-to-face U.S.-Iraqi talks. And so it's the beginning of a dialogue with a country with which we've had extremely strained relations. But I think, and in my interviews with Ambassador Crocker, is quite clear to me that he believes that is the course we have to follow, because Iran is a major player in the Middle East. We have to understand why it does what it does. One can't be naive about its regional ambitions, but it is going to have a relationship with Iraq, and that is not something that the U.S. should oppose. What they are attempting to do, and what we'll see the next administration's policy approach will be, there's clearly some activity, though, that Iran has been undertaking in Iraq that is destabilizing the country. And just as on the Sunni side, what you want to do is not treat all Sunnis as the enemy, but you absolutely do want to identify those bomb makers and those people who are hell-bent on causing hundreds of casualties, and most of them civilian Iraqi casualties. So I think the whole point here is you had two leaders who were really all about making the right distinctions and trying to both reach out to adversaries, protect the civilian population, and devise those kinds of countermeasures against the real threats. So I think they worked quite well together, and that's one of the big lessons that I see Petraeus now trying to apply with regard to his wider responsibility as Central Command Chief, where he has Afghanistan, Pakistan as part of his area. He's saying, let's define the problem correctly, and then let's get both the diplomatic and the military approach in sync. And this sounds so basic, but frankly, we have not done that, and that really has to be the starting point for successful policies.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest. We're a bit past our midpoint here. Our guest, Linda Robinson, has covered wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Latin America, as well as other national security issues, as senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. She now is author in residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She's also contributed to a number of other publications, including Foreign Affairs, The New Republic, and also World Policy Journal. She was also a senior editor of Foreign Affairs. She was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University, and she's the author of a newly published book, a fairly recently published book. The title is Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. It's published by Public Affairs. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll go on here to another caller, and that's Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Starting with your last paragraphs there, it's just not true that the U.S. hasn't had talks with Iran. I mean, you can go back to the Iran-Contra era when the Reagan administration was arming both sides in the Iran-Iraq War, and obviously there had to be in talks. You can look at the attack on the Taliban in Afghanistan when the U.S. talked with Iran about helping aid the Northern League, our minions, and their minions, too, somewhat in destabilizing. So just as a matter of not not being aware of what kind of machinations and other things that go on, I mean, obviously official talks can be something else, but to just to assert that, you know, we've never shared shared strategies and goals with Iran is just I mean, it needs to be addressed. I wanted to know if you knew and investigated the suicide of the military ethicist Westerhosing. It's not much commented on in the major press. There's a Texas Observer story from midsummer about his suicide note and how critical he was of Petraeus. He said, "I cannot support a mission that leads to corruption, human rights abuses, and liars. I am sullied no more." This is his suicide note. "I didn't volunteer to support corrupt, money-grubbing contractors or to work with commanders only interested in themselves." It's a chilling thing. This kind of it's overwhelming me actually at this point. But for no one to comment on it, David had a guest who worked with Petraeus a couple years later and hadn't even been told about this story. I assume it's not something that they want to talk about. And I don't know whether you investigated it either. It sounds like since you collaborated with West. With Petraeus on the on rewriting the counterinsurgency manual in some way, at least contributing something to it, being on a panel, a committee with him, that you're well ensconced in it. As a question, a simple sort of question, we know about Petraeus paying off various factions, and that was one of the things that suppressed the surge. But there was also in the book by the idea that new innovations in death squads were also one of the things that happened. I'm drawing a blank on the Watergate reporter who's scribed to Bush's war.
Woodward.
Yes, indeed. That he's saying that he can't talk about it, but he can point at it as being a major part of this success. What can you tell us about that? And I assume you'll want to address some of the other things that I've brought up, too.
Well, Ms. Robinson, go ahead.
Yes, well, that's a long list of things, and clearly the caller is, as are so many Americans, deeply offended and upset by the fact that the U.S. has been bogged down in Iraq all of this time, and indeed even chose to go in there. And I certainly can fully appreciate that, and I'm really looking at this as the U.S. chose to do this, and the last year plus, 2 years plus, have been aimed at how do you undo the errors of the early part of the war and how do you get out with the least possible damage to U.S. interests in that region, which are substantial. And some people, such as your caller, may not agree that there are U.S. interests there, but pretty much any Middle East expert would agree to that. I do want to address first the point about the dialogue. I should have been more precise. There have been any number of contacts, U.S. and Iran, but this is the first time there's been a systematic diplomatic dialogue that's been opened on regional security issues. And that's my point is I think we will see that continuing. That was the initiation of that, and I think there are signals from the incoming administration of President-elect Obama that they will take that and go much further. Contracting abuses have certainly occurred, and people who are interested in looking more deeply into that. I include some of that in my book, but there's a lot really detailed reports on online available that were produced by the Special Inspector General for Iraq, or SIGIR, S-I-G-I-R, led by Stuart Bowen, who is the lead investigator. And they, in fact, have an office over in the embassy annex there, which used to be the Republican Guard Palace. They've now all moved over to the newly built U.S. embassy. But there, I think that the suicide of the man was very unfortunate. He was clearly very upset by what he saw going on. But again, this is part of a big picture, and your caller obviously has one picture, which is that this whole thing was a misadventure, and everybody involved he would like to cast as a villain. And I would just, I guess, like to push back and say, from what I saw, there were many people trying to make what is, for our generation, our Vietnam War. I mean, this is the biggest war we've been involved in since Vietnam, and I dare say is the biggest war we're going to be involved in. And I think that people who are close students of history will want to separate out and not paint everyone with the same brush. My involvement in the counterinsurgency manual was simply, I was invited to critique it along with a large group of people, which I thought was a very interesting exercise that General Petraeus undertook. He invited a number of human rights groups, Human Rights Watch, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, to come and critique this manual, and they registered some very sharp criticisms of the draft, and they were taken into account, and those changes were made. You know, the normal procedure would have been a manual would have been produced behind closed doors with only officials and possibly only the military looking at it. And his approach instead was, let's get everybody in the room, everybody throw their darts at it, and let's go back to the board and try to produce something that people will feel is a good guide.
I have another caller here. I guess, though, I would like to give the caller an opportunity for a very quick follow-up, if you would like to.
Well, I'll just say that I know we have interest in the regions, but I think that occupying even in a small residual force, which you seem to be anxious to have confirmed that the Iraqis will accept, is not going to be a route to any kind of real stability in the region. I think we need a demilitarization of the entire region, as was called for in the settlement of so-called settlement of the first incursion into Iraq at the time of the Kuwait imbroglio. A broader image of the Middle East, even having over the horizon a new base in Kuwait, et cetera, is not going to lead to long-term stability. It's just going to make for a protracted war. I think we need more authentic diplomacy and not just statecraft, which includes the threat of force, and so I obviously disagree with the Council for Foreign Relations in a great as pointed out. So I'll listen and to the rest of the show. Thanks.
All right. Well, let's go on. We have another caller. We have somebody here on a cell phone. This is on our line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I would like her to speak about the refugee problem. How it's going to end up? You know, what the Sunni and the Shiite population, are they going to be separated, or will they be able to go back and resume their lives as they were before the war?
That's a great question, and I'm glad that you brought it up. I want to just very briefly respond to the additional comment by the previous caller.
Oh, sure,
I think it's extremely important that people understand it is going to be up to the government of Iraq to ask for whatever assistance it wants. And that's, I think, what the caller perhaps misunderstands. And it is I have made many trips and interviewed many Iraqis, and I can tell you there are things that they will say. Right now they're facing elections. It's hard for them to say a lot of things publicly in the face of elections, but they know that they are not ready to completely defend their country by themselves, and there's a great concern about Iran within Iraq, and anyone who knows the history of the Middle East knows why. And my book heavily advocates a diplomatic role. That's really what Chapter 15 is all about. So I don't want people to have a misperception about my views or my book based on what that caller said. As far as the refugee population, this is a very delicate problem, because if people are not allowed to come back into Iraq and return to, if not their homes, to a place they want to live, things will get hardened into stone, and we saw that in the Balkans. I was very heartened when I returned to Iraq in August and September, that many families had in fact come back to Baghdad, which was the epicenter of this sectarian violence. About 5,000 families, which translates to about 25,000, had moved back in. Now, it's a small number when you consider 4 million, but it is still early days. And I think that that is the trend that Maliki, the prime minister, is actually doing a lot to try to fly people back, offering up free plane rides back in. The problem comes when people who are living in those homes do not want to leave. And there are two reasons why they do not want to leave. One is, of course, obviously, they're afraid if they go back to their old neighborhood, and whether they be Shia or Sunni, they're afraid that the same people who chased them out before will still be back there. The other reason, quite frankly, why there is some resistance is many people have moved into much larger and better homes, and they may have been renting before, and if they are now, especially if they're in these homes now without any kind of legal lease, you know, they're in essence living rent-free. So there's a very delicate problem here that has to be dealt with, and I would say we cannot leave it up to the Iraqi government, which was the initial response of the U.S. military. They just did not, because this is such a delicate issue. They wanted the Iraqi government to take ownership of it. But now you have two things happening. The UN Special Envoy, Stefan de Mistura, has taken on this issue, and the various UN entities are getting quite involved also in the expatriate refugees, those outside the country, and trying to round up additional help for them, not only to be, we don't want permanent refugee populations in those countries. That's one of the reasons why there are strained relations between Iraq and its neighbors, among other things. And finally, there are efforts by individual U.S. military units on the ground in neighborhoods that I've seen. They get together a group of local notables, the imams, the school teachers, the elders, etc., and they say, look, you have to get together as a community and work out who is going to live where and come up with solutions, which is kind of an ad hoc approach, but I think getting communities involved in bringing peace to their communities, to me, looks like a good idea at a grassroots level. So what you need to do is knit together all of those approaches with the multilateral organizations' help, the U.S. with lending a hand, and then at this community-based level.
Just, I wonder if we could return, and we have maybe about 7-8 minutes. Talk a little bit more about the U.S. policy that came to be generally referred to as the surge, the thing that I think is very much associated with General Petraeus and also with some of his commanders that put this together. And I think that probably when people think about the surge, the thing that first of all they're going to think about is the fact that additional troops were put in. But there was more to it just than the fact that we sent another 30,000 soldiers. Again, I think here, in part I'm thinking about a previous caller, but other people have said, well, you know, really what happened here was that we managed to buy off the Sunni tribal sheikhs and get them over to our side. And the only reason that they're working with us now is that we're paying them. A number of people have various sorts of ways for explaining why the surge worked and whether we can expect that to be some sort of a long-term effect or can be sort of short-term. I guess I'm interested in having you talk about the surge and its various components and then, you know, why it is that that for people who argue that it worked, you know, what do they say really has gone on here?
Yes, great. Thank you for asking that question, because there are, frankly, a lot of misperceptions and even outright falsehoods about what actually happened. It wasn't only the numbers, and one could even argue that the different approach could have been applied conceivably with the same numbers and would have had good effect. So it's very important that people understand what brought about this dramatic decline in violence. that I think no matter what happens ahead, this is going to be recognized as a really phenomenal period in the annals of this war. The attacks just dramatically plummeted over this period of time. And it was primarily the Sunnis who had been fighting U.S. and Iraqi forces and their supporters, because every insurgency needs a support base. Those people decided to stop fighting when this outreach program began. And it really began at a neighborhood level. In June 2nd, 2007, Petraeus said had a commander's conference and told all of the commanders, reconciliation works. Tribal engagement works, get out there and do it. I want each of you doing it. And really, from that time forward, Sunnis began coming over. By September 07, there were some 15,000, 16,000 already come in, and by the end of the year, 70,000, and the numbers wound up to be 90,000. That number represents the vast majority of the Sunni insurgency and the people supporting the Sunni insurgency. And that, what I call the flipping of the insurgency, occurred not just because we were willing to pay them $10 a day. That's one of these myths that's out there, that somehow $10 a day brought these people over. Not correct. They were brought over for two reasons. The violence that was going on in 2006 convinced the Sunnis that their backs were to the wall. They were going to be liquidated or pushed out of the country. So when Petraeus comes along and reaches out his hand saying, are you ready to quit fighting? Will you come in and reconcile with this government? And we will work to get you a place in the new Iraq, both a new job, a role in the security force, and some local political representation. And that is the formula that is now being worked for peace in Iraq. And it's really, this is where about midway through the peacemaking effort, and that's why I'm so adamant that what we have to do is continue the peacemaking and diplomatic overtures to get the political concessions that are needed to permanently end this war. But what happened was the Sunnis decided that they were ready to stop fighting. The other tactics that were applied with great success were putting up concrete walls in the neighborhoods and markets that were getting hit by the bombs and that were the sources of bombs. Now, this was very controversial and quite criticized in the beginning, but it worked, and people's lives were saved as a result. There was also a large campaign to identify more precisely who were the actual bomb makers, and this was used by these techniques involve both technology. Biometric scans were used for the insurgent suspects, and they were put into a database that was then shared widely so the troops would not keep kicking in doors of the wrong houses. And so you did have a certain amount of kinetic action, military raids going on to find the bomb makers and those people who were part of the hardcore, what they came to call the irreconcilable insurgents, those people who did not accept the offer to come in from the cold. And I would just add the comment about the death squads that I think arose from some interpretations of the Woodward book, which frankly, I mean, Woodward never went to Iraq, and his reporting is, it's really a Washington-based book. But there were some of the new technologies developed were aimed at identifying with greater precision who the bomb makers were. And what's critical in an insurgency and counterinsurgency environment is that you not attack the wrong people, that you not arrest the wrong people, because then you've just converted that entire family over to the adversary column. So I think what we saw going on here in the last year and a half was greater precision in targeting those people who were actually involved in the violence. I won't sit here and tell you that everyone picked up was a bona fide insurgent. But from what I saw, there was a lot more discretion in those targets. And by the way, there's been a lot of release of those detainees. Now, of course, they're all going to go over to Iraqi control with the new agreement. But over 17,000 now have been released, as a lot of people have realized it's better to have these people out in the community with the tribal sheikhs who have taken kind of the parole officer role and agreed to incorporate them back into the community. So that's just, anyway, a quick rundown of the various things that happened.
Yeah, we have maybe about 3 minutes left, and I realize this is complicated, but I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the government of Iraq, because certainly there has been a great deal of criticism directed towards the Iraqi government, and particularly at Nouri al-Maliki, for, in a sense, dragging its feet, for failing to move towards trying to put together an actual functioning government, for not doing a terribly good job in getting the Iraqi army and the security forces ready to actually take over the security job from the U.S. Army, and also perhaps for failing really to deal effectively with divisions among the Shia, particularly between Mr. Maliki and Muqtada al-Sadr. I wonder what you can say about any of that in a couple of minutes.
Yes, well, I will do my best, but the intra-Shia politics of Iraq are extraordinarily complicated, and I go into them in some detail. But what you have within the intra-Shia grouping are three main Islamist parties: Dawah, ISKI, which is the closest to Iran, and Sadr, which has a mass base among the poor Shia and is more nationalist oriented because of the legacy of Sadr. And I think that is actually the longest. That element has to be part of any government, and I think will be going forward. What happened over 2007, 2008 was the Sadr movement itself was split. Those that had become quite tied up with Iran and were getting arms and training from Iran were really Sadr eventually came to denounce those elements. And I think that he's now looking at the political path for as his best way forward, because he does have a mass base. The Dawah party of Nouri al-Maliki is the smallest of the three, so they've had to strike different bargains with these other two Shia groupings in order to get its agenda moved forward. So it's an extremely complicated picture. And beyond that, I would add, those three parties do not represent the entirety of the Shia population. In fact, so many Iraqis say, please don't just put us into these Shia-Sunni categories. Many of them want a secular politics. They want a non-sectarian politics. And that's what these next two elections, I think, are going to show, is you're going to have more groups coming into representation, and the parliamentary system of Iraq is good for this purpose, because what you're going to have for this foreseeable future are coalition governments, and the more people who can be represented in those coalition governments, the more you have a chance of working out the political compromises that represent all Iraqi parties.
Well, I think at that point we're going to have to finish. For people who want to read more, you can look for the book that we mentioned. The title of the book is Tell Me How This Ends, General David Petraeus and the Search for a Way Out of Iraq. Public Affairs is the publisher. Our guest, Linda Robinson, the author. She's former senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. She is now author in residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And Ms. Robinson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Support for Focus 580, our program, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com.
WILL programs are made possible by Pages for All Ages books, music, cafe, and DVDs in Savoy. Pages Cafe serves steep and brew coffees, espressos, lattes, and tea drinks. Pages Cafe also offers cookies and pastries from local bakeries. Route 45 and Curtis Road in Savoy.
And the broadcast also made possible today by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, experienced full-time professional agents listing and selling homes in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned for the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be the director of the Family Resiliency Center at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Barbara Fees. We'll talk with her about the benefits of having dinner together for the family, for the health and well-being of the family. She'll join us at 106. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat trading at 567. That's up 6. March, 580 3/4, up 5 3/4. Chicago, December wheat, 529, down 3/4. March, 554, up 4 1/2. December corn, 378 1/2, down 1 1/2. March, 395, down 1 1/2. May, 4.